You have specified hazel eyes, dark hair, and fair skin. I've taken the liberty of eradicating any potentially prejudicial conditions. Premature baldness, myopia, alcoholism, and addictive susceptibility, propensity for violence, obesity, etc.
We didn't want... I mean, diseases, yes, but...
Right. We were just wondering if it's good to just leave a few things to chance.
You want to give your child the best possible start. Believe me, we have enough imperfection built in already. No, your child doesn't need any additional burdens. And keep in mind, this child is still you. Simply the best of you. You could conceive naturally 1,000 times and never get such a result.
Giving your child the best possible start, a vexed issue we're starting the show with today. That's a scene from the now iconic 1997 sci-fi film Gattaca. Sci-fi then edging closer to reality now, perhaps. Many consider the genetic screening and selection of embryos as, oh, look, a symbol of remarkable progress in modern medicine. Others are perhaps more concerned by what these technologies might mean for human diversity. Have you asked yourself whether you would go ahead or not with a pregnancy if you found a firm genetic marker for a disease or a cancer, perhaps? What else would you select for if you could? Eye colour? Height? Skin tone, intelligence, sporting prowess. It's a fantasy land in many cases, of course. Most of our features are defined by more than one gene, usually many genes interacting with each other in the world. But this question of whether it's right or wrong to create so-called designer babies is the subject of an Intelligence Squared debate tomorrow night at the City Recital Hall in Sydney. And joining me now are two guests who'll be going head-to-head on this one. We have David Weisbrot. He's Professor of Legal Policy at the United States Studies Centre at the University of Sydney. He's a member of the Human Genetics Advisory Committee of the National Health and Medical Research Council, and he's also former president of the Australian Law Reform Commission, who really took on a lot of these issues during his tenancy. Welcome, David.
Good morning, Natasha.
And we also have bioethicist Professor Julian Savulescu, who's director of the UHERO Centre for Practical Ethics at Oxford University, where he is also director of the Oxford Centre for Neuroethics and the Institute for Science and Ethics. Welcome back to Australia, Julian.
Yes, I'm here for a few weeks.
You are indeed. Julian, let's start with you. What kinds of traits or genes are we able to and do we confidently screen for now? What's scientifically feasible?
Well, at the moment, the only genes that are screened for are genes for what are deemed as sufficiently serious diseases, so inherited diseases like cystic fibrosis or Down syndrome and some adult onset cancers like some forms of bowel cancer and breast cancer. But in fact, not even all diseases are screened for that could be screened for. Those deemed sufficiently minor and are not allowed to be. You can't, for example, test for carriers. So at the moment, essentially, people are allowed to test for what bodies like, you know, the regulatory bodies in Victoria allow them to screen for.
Mm. Well, to both of you, given what we can test for now, what do you think is appropriate for parents and clinicians to nominate to test for? David?
Well, of course, there's a wide spectrum of possibilities, and I think at the least ethically objectionable are the sorts of ones that Julian spoke about. So serious diseases where there's a high likelihood that it will manifest and we don't have good treatments for them, and so on. As you move into the middle, I mean, do you screen out things like allergies? You just spoke about the start of spring, asthma, other kind of, you know, medical conditions that aren't life-threatening. And then at the most frivolous or certainly superficial end of it, you've got things like hair color, eye color, and certain sorts of putative characteristics like musical ability or sporting ability.
Mm-hmm. So where do you think the line should be drawn, David?
Well, I would draw the line pretty far back at the very serious, non-treatable diseases that have a high likelihood of manifesting. Even there, I have some concerns, though, I have to say, although I wouldn't, you know, I would not be so bold as to say to individuals in that situation, sorry, you can't make a reproductive choice because I have a concern about where this leads. But we know, for example, in terms of preserving biodiversity, that many of the things we now treat as serious diseases were things that in past, conditions in the past, actually assisted, provided an advantage in terms of survival. So some of the diseases that are now very serious, like hemochromatosis, Tay-Sachs, sickle cell disease, beta thalassemia, those are all things that actually conferred an advantage. They helped against, protected against malaria. They conserved iron in the blood. So people who had poor diets, who were always fighting like Vikings and losing blood, actually had that advantage. So, you know, we don't know what we're doing if we eliminate all or eliminate a significant part of biodiversity.
There's a deeper history to our genetic tale here. Julian Savulescu, you've been much more liberal on this question and have firmly argued that we have a moral duty or even a legitimate moral reason to test for much, much more, haven't you?
Yeah, well, the knowledge will be out there, and you've got to remember the only reason in a liberal society to stop people using knowledge and making choices is when they directly harm other people. Now, I wouldn't allow selections in favour of genes that predispose to violence or psychopathy. I think people shouldn't be allowed to select for those. But apart from those genes that clearly create harmful traits, I think people should be free to choose anything. And indeed, they should be encouraged to choose for things that allow for a healthier life and indeed a better life. We now know that some traits that aren't, for example, the ability to exercise sufficient self-control are fundamentally associated with future life prospects. And these arguments about biodiversity are simply out of date now. We don't survive as a human species from AIDS by finding the few genetically resistant human beings and allowing them to repopulate the world. We develop preventative and treatment strategies. So if we adopted that kind of strategy, we wouldn't even allow testing for cystic fibrosis because it protects against diarrhea. So, you know, what was right for one time is not necessarily right for another time.
Well, Julian, let's just take this idea of a better life. You think that that the parent should make a decision, a screening decision on the basis of the likelihood of the child leading the best life. What constitutes a best life for you? By what definition?
Well, you know, that's obviously where the money is, that having that debate. But there are certain things that we can say do make for it. After all, we try to educate our children, we try to set up institutions. So we want our children to finish childhood by being intelligent, able to live with other people, cooperative, able to understand other people's emotions and respond appropriately, able to exercise self-control and delay gratification for more important future rewards. All of those traits are things that there's a fair degree of consensus in our society, commitment to liberalism, tolerance, equality. Those sorts of values are values that I think we reasonably share. And insofar as we can identify genes that contribute to, say, altruism, and there is a gene, or to self-control, we should select in favour of those.
It's only one gene, though. I mean, our values are shaped by our upbringing, our culture, and also a genetic heritage.
Of course they are, but, you know, everything is a combination of the choices we make, our biology and our social environment. But just because our social environment doesn't fully determine who we are doesn't stop us trying to shape that. And likewise, just because our genes only contribute to who we are shouldn't stop us from trying to control part of the equation.
So just before I come to David, what about a trait like deafness? Deaf people have a clear, sophisticated cultural identity defined by their disability. What about the obligation to screen out deafness, for example? Julian?
Oh, sorry, I thought that was to David. Screening out deafness. Well, again, I think deafness is a disability in the sort of world that we live in. It does represent a hurdle, although people can live very good lives. It still places people at a disadvantage. But, you know, people should be free to make choices that don't harm other people. And when you select to have a deaf child, you're not harming other people. That child wouldn't have existed otherwise. So I think people should be free to make that choice, even though I personally think that it's inflicting a disadvantage on a child.
Okay, David Weisbrot, this question of parental choice, should parents have open slather in terms of the choices they can make, in terms of what they screen for and what they don't screen for, as Julian is making the strong case for?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I think for a number of reasons, our understanding of the science is not so far advanced that those decisions will necessarily be informed or intelligent or effective ones. And so I keep reading about databases of Nobel Prize winners' sperms being available on the internet and other databases that have, you know, Miss America winners and Miss Universe. And I keep thinking, well, the most likely result of that is you'll get a kid who looks like Einstein and thinks like Paris Hilton.
Right.
I mean, we don't have that level of control or certainty. When Julian was laying out all of those things, I mean, he talked about the rights of the individual, but then immediately shifted over into communitarian values, liberty, equality, fraternity, being able to work with others. But those are none of the traits that actually people are suggesting they would select for. They're very selfish ones. They want to give their child an advantage. How do we make our child better, perfect, you know, more competitive than others? They're not looking for that social aspect of it. So that concerns me. It also worries me about the kind of world we're going to live in. I mean, is it going to be the world of the Stepford Wives, or is it a world of diversity? Is it going to be what we saw on our TV screens a few weeks ago, the Republican convention or the Democratic convention? I've spent a career in academia promoting diversity, saying that our kids learn best and most when they work with others who come from different backgrounds, who have different perspectives, different life experiences, and that enriches everybody. If we narrow it down to some idealized view of, Miss America and the captain of the rugby team, then I think we're really eliminating a lot of what brings richness to our culture.
But if
and
we
our
have
society.
The knowledge, Julian is making the argument that we should use it. We should have the choice to use it.
Well, I'm not sure we really have the knowledge. I mean,
but
have
if we
the
did
beginnings.
Have the knowledge, let's think hypothetically here.
Yeah.
If we did have the knowledge, should we not exercise a choice to use it?
I still have some concern about taking some of the magic out of life, I guess, and programming everything down. We have 3.2 billion base pairs of genetic information, each of us, and how far along the line are we going to go to actually program all of that? I mean, I think we've done pretty well as a species. Well, I could do better, but I mean, we've done pretty well as a species, allowing things to run and using that medical knowledge for better diagnosis, better treatment. I'd rather spend the money on public health. And I don't see a clamor for this in Asia or Africa. It's a very kind of white middle class idea that we'll take our already very healthy and privileged kids and make them a bit more perfect. I mean, I'd like to see some of that resource actually devoted to the millions of kids who are starving or suffering from curable diseases.
This is Life Matters on ABC RN. Natasha Mitchell with you. I'm joined by David Weisbrot. He's a Professor of Legal Policy at the United States Studies Centre at the University of Sydney, amongst many other roles, and Professor Julian Savulescu, Director of the UHERO Centre for Practical Ethics at Oxford University. And we're talking about designer babies. Julian, it can fly the other way, can't it? There was that famous case early part of this century in the US where a deaf lesbian couple chose a deaf sperm donor in an attempt to ensure their child would also be deaf because they were very affiliated with their cultural identity of being deaf. How did you read that situation? Because that was the choice that you're arguing for exercised in a slightly different way.
Yeah, no, I've written on this. I mean, I think it's, you know, a wonderful example of the value of freedom, that people choose to make different choices, and this idea that everyone will choose the same thing, I think this just shows that that's wrong. And people should be able to exercise freedom, provided it doesn't cost society a huge amount of money and make it very difficult to sustain those sorts of choices on a large scale. But there is clearly the resources to enable people to make those choices, and I think they should be free to, even though I disagree with them. And they're making a choice on what they think is the best kind of child to have for them. So I think that you've got to remember that these choices are being made today in the US. There are no controls over reproduction and genetic testing in the US, although there are severe controls in Australia. Mm. We'd be much better off having a decent debate about what we should allow people and indeed encourage them to select for. And you have to remember that, you know, these sort of stories about everyone choosing blonde hair and blue eyes, you're going to have 10, 20 embryos. You're only going to be able to select for a couple of conditions at most. And so it will be sensible to select the things that really do fundamentally affect your child's prospects, like adequate self-control. So, you know, I don't think you're going to see a contraction of genetic diversity anytime soon.
Julian, if we were able to screen for a wide range of traits or diseases or disabilities, does this then, I mean, choices have consequences beyond the individuals who make the choice. They have social consequences, and so many make the case that it shifts the moral and economic responsibility of those choices onto the parents of the child. So they get blamed if they choose to not have a screening that, say, screens out a particular disability. And so then, you know, they're basically left, for example, the argument could be made that they are financially responsible then for that child.
Yeah, well, we already have a natural experiment in the form of screening for Down syndrome and other genetic disorders. And, you know, it's obvious if somebody hasn't employed Down syndrome screening. And it is sometimes argued that people are blamed for those choices. But nobody is suggesting that the people who choose not to have testing for Down syndrome and have a child with Down syndrome should be paying for the care of their child. I mean, that just is not occurring. And
that argument could be made, though, couldn't it?
It could be made. Lots of arguments can be made. But the question is, you know, are they reasonable and sustainable? And I don't think they are. I mean, we don't punish people who have deaf children. We don't punish people. And these sorts of traits, I mean, whether you test for intelligence or self-control or these sorts of things won't be obvious to other people in the way that if you've not tested for Down syndrome, it will. So, I think this is, again, scaremongering, this kind of argumentation to sort of raise some potential science fiction disasters to undermine what is potentially a very valuable and important technology, and that is trying to understand the relationship between science and who we are and the differences between who we are and what sorts of prospects we have.
Interesting point. David Weisbrod, it was reported in the Herald recently, Sydney Morning Herald, that fertile Australian women with genes that predispose them to breast cancer and ovarian cancer, so the BRCA1 and BRCA2 mm-hmm. genes, were electing to undergo IVF and screen out embryos that possessed those genes because they were concerned about the risk it conferred to the embryo later in life. Mm-hmm. What do you make of that?
I understand it. I know that there are, it runs strongly in families, that there are, I guess, the lived experience of some of those women is that they've had a whole range of close relatives who've suffered from breast cancer or colorectal cancer. So I understand that. The penetrance of breast cancer is about 60-80%.
So just to explain that, if you've got the gene, it doesn't mean
there's about a 20-40% chance that it won't manifest and about a 60-80% chance that it will. Of course, the majority of women who develop breast cancer don't have that marker at all. So it's no guarantee at all. It's just an indicator of a particular genetic mutation that predisposes someone to this. Treatment for breast cancer is much better. Again, that's in that area in the gray zone, I think, where I would have trouble telling someone not to do that if that's been their experience. On the other hand, I would like them to work with
a sister.
I'd like them to work with a good counselor to explain the options and also to explain very clearly what the probabilities are, what the actual risk is. Because the research we did at the Law Reform Commission suggested that people really didn't understand genetic risk, that they, once they got the label, that they were terrified of contracting the disease, whether or not that was really very likely.
Julian Savulescu, do you distinguish between this concept of a best life or the best life and the perfect life in this conversation?
Yeah, you're never going to get the perfect life. And when you say best, when you're talking about 10 or 20 embryos, it's going to be a range. I mean, you're just making... You're in practice, you're going to be, you know, aiming for something that's better than chance. And that's the critical point, that evolution doesn't distribute genes with any kind of eye to the things that we think are important, such as happiness or longevity or having the capacity to you know, change the world and realise what you want. It just enables you to live long enough to reproduce. And so there's a huge range of genes that people get. And, you know, that's distributed randomly. And different people have different talents and abilities and advantages and disadvantages. And, you know, my view is that we should use our knowledge to try to do better than just mere chance. And we're just selecting between, you know, individuals that could have existed and the one that starts off with the best opportunities or better opportunities than the others on the basis of the evidence we have.
David Weisbrot.
That only comes into play if you're talking about people who are going through IVF and then producing surplus embryos that can be tested, that those embryos are then subjected to another procedure, the pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, so that you understand the genome of the particular child. I mean, that the huge bulk of births obviously are not that way, and I don't think most people will want to go through IVF purely for that limited kind of selection that Julian's talking about. Again, it's not actually assembling the 3.2 billion bits. It's making a few choices here or there. It's also not a random assignation. I mean, genetics is inherited. We know but roughly what our families are bringing to the table when you have two partners. I think Julian also left out one important thing, which is that a lot of those are views, in fact, all of our views, really, about what's perfect or preferable or better, is culturally determined. And that culture changes very dramatically. Our view of feminine beauty has certainly changed over 100 years. So again, I worry, I'm not making a slippery slope, you know, Gattaca, Brave New World argument. I'm making much more of a, if we decide these things in the short term, what sort of damage are we doing in the long term to human diversity?
And Julian Savulescu, a final comment from you in response to David.
Well, I think that's exactly at the heart of the debate, this moral relativism that values and what's right and wrong is just dependent on the culture that you live in or the preferences you have. And I think that's profoundly mistaken. And I think the whole movement towards equality has been a movement towards consensus and some universal human values. And I think those are the ones that we need to identify if we're to have any protection against any abuse, not just in genetics, but through the use of any technology. And I think that's where the debate is. And, you know, I think that we have come to realise after 100 or so years that there are some robust values and some things really are right and wrong and not just in the eyes of the beholder.
Well, gosh, we could go for hours on this one. look, delighted to have you both on the program, and I know this will elicit a big response from Life Matters listeners. And thank you, Julian Savulescu, Director of the UHERO Centre for Practical Ethics at Oxford University, and David Weisbrot, Professor of Legal Policy at the United States Studies Centre at the University of Sydney. And the debate kicks off tomorrow night in Sydney at the Recital Hall. I think it's the Intelligence Squared, and we'll pop the link on our website. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Look, you're with Life Matters. Get on our Facebook page on this one. Many of you already are. facebook.com/rnlifematters and our website abc.net.au/radionational. Look for Life Matters and you can link to all our social media platforms from our homepage. Do that and get talking about this one. 0283 1430 is our listener line. 0283 1430 if you'd like to leave a verbal story instead of all these digital means. Coming up next, well, being prepared for natural disasters.